You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You just found the very best in original talk radio broadcasting on the internet. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want. You're listening to On the Couch, with Dr. Michelle on LA Talk Radio.
Well, good morning, everybody, and happy day to you. This is your friendly psychologist, Dr. Michelle. That's me. And for the next almost hour or so, we're going to have a great show together. We always talk about psychological issues. I'm the relationship expert here on LA Talk Radio. But we also talk about a lot of other things, too. Problems people have, issues, you know, just dealing with life in general. And what I do a lot of times is I encourage you to write me. You can contact me on my website, drmichelletherapy.com, drmichelletherapy.com. That's two L's in my name. Therapy is T-H-E-R-A-P-Y. And it's drmichelletherapy.com. Go ahead, click on that, and you'll find out more about me, what I'm about, my philosophies, and also how you can email me if you have questions. I do have several questions that I'm going to share with you on the air. Hopefully, these folks are listening. I already contacted you and got your permission to say your name on the air and also ask these questions. And also, yeah, sure, you want to go ahead and write me? My email is docmichelle@aol.com. So we are broadcasting live as we usually are out of the beautiful studios here in Studio City, California, moments away from Hollywood in Los Angeles, where so much of the media, entertainment, films, television networks exist, and that's us right here. And we do have one of the, if not the most popular internet talk show on the web, internationally. So get ready. I have a great guest coming up today. We're going to be talking about psychiatry, taking medications. You know, there's still some stigma about having to see a psychiatrist. Yeah, a lot of people go, oh God, I went to see a psychiatrist. They're really embarrassed about it. The concept of mental illness treatment to a lot of folks and family members is scary. A lot of people don't even understand what a psychiatrist does. Some folks think they do the same thing as I do as a psychologist, but no. A psychiatrist is a medical physician who's qualified to diagnose and treat mental illness and, you know, specializes in the prevention of other problems like substance abuse and addictive behaviors. So they prescribe meds and they treat psychological disorders. So for many people, visits with a psychiatrist are a life-saving measure. You know that, right? You've heard about people maybe in your family or friends. They saved my life. I've got on some antidepressants. I finally got on some anti-anxiety medication. My life is saved. And as a matter of fact, I've had several clients say to me, this guy who I'm going to have on my show has saved their lives today. I've worked with this gentleman for over 15 years. And he's Dr. Alan Crowman, who's a psychiatrist here in Los Angeles. He's been a spokesperson on national television, on a lot of different networks in the news. And as a matter of fact, he's calling in. Let's say hi to Alan, just to see if we can get him pulled up on the phone. And let's see. All right, I'm going to wait for him just a little bit, and then we're going to call him, see if he can call in. But what he will do, hopefully today, is help clear up some of these misconceptions that everybody has about psychologists, about psychiatrists. And the good news is that society has progressed in understanding and recognizing the different things that can contribute to stress and other triggers. I mean, people are getting it. In the media, there's a lot of superstars. There's a lot of high-profile news media people out there, politicians, who have mental illness. Or who have issues, depression, anxiety, phobias, you know, problems associated with mental health. So it's becoming a lot more well-known in society. And everybody in the world has depression. Everybody has fears, scary thoughts from time to time. Everybody has self-doubt. But what we're dealing with here is the extent to which you feel these things and how they affect the way you function. So right now, let's go on the line. And good morning. It's Dr. Michelle. And I believe I have Dr. Alan Croman on the line with me. Hey.
Yes, you do.
Hi, Alan. How are you?
I'm doing well, Michelle. How are you doing?
I'm great. So thank you so much for calling in today because I
know... Oh, my pleasure.
Oh, I know you're going to be such a great help to people. I did get a lot of questions, which I filtered through, which I solicited for within the last week because I told folks on my website that I was going to be having you on the air. And if they had any questions about psychiatric issues, medications, to write me so we can talk about some of those things as well, if it's cool with you.
Absolutely. My pleasure to be able to be on with you.
All righty. Let me first of all, folks, let you know that Dr. Alan Croman does have a practice here in Los Angeles, and he is a general and geriatric psychiatrist, and he's also assistant clinical professor at UCLA, so he knows his stuff. So any questions you might have, shoot, folks, out there, because he will help you out. And we were talking about a little bit earlier, Alan, clearing up some of the misconceptions, you know, about psychiatry and, you know, finally society's progressed in understanding that, you know, different things contribute, you know, in society.
Absolutely. I don't know how many patients I see who are anxious about coming in to see a therapist or psychiatrist for fear that it is going to be at some point either painful or shameful. That the process is going to be difficult and hurt, or that if someone finds out that they're getting help, that they'll be seen as being not good enough, not strong enough, or just plain old crazy.
Right, exactly. Well, let me just familiarize my audience with you a little bit. How long have you been practicing psychiatry? And I think a lot of people want to know, why the heck did you get into this kind of medical profession? What made you decide to be a psychiatrist?
I've been in private practice now for 26 years out here in West L.A., I think the seeds of my practice were sown very early on. Some of my parents' friends were psychiatrists, and I know the type of respect they were afforded in the family. And it set me along that road early on. The truth be told, in medical school, for me, it was almost a toss-up between psychiatry, emergency room, or orthopedics. I like to do things with my hands.
Yeah.
I think in the long run, I found that hanging out with the psychiatrist was just a lot more fun than hanging out with the surgeons.
Right. That's right. So you did that. And so now that you're into it and you've been doing it for years, and I actually personally, folks, have worked with him. You were the medical director of a clinic when I first met you.
Yes,
and,
indeed.
You were the main man who really oversaw a lot of the most or all of the clinical cases we were dealing with. And we were, it was a residential in-house and outpatient treatment center, folks. So we're dealing with full-blown psychiatric issues here. And I, you know, I heard every day when I was leading groups from a lot of clients and their family members, a lot of common misconceptions about psychiatric medications, psychiatric disorders, and you know there's such a stigma attached to it. Like, oh, this is the family member we don't really, we want to kind of stay away from because it's really uncomfortable, you know. So, what do you see some of the most common misconceptions about psychiatry from patients or family members?
I think the most common misconception is that in going to a psychiatrist, you're identifying that you are crazy, that you're shameful, or that you just can't handle life.
Right.
We should consider that the whole idea of psychiatric diagnosis and treatment is new in terms of history.
Mm-hmm.
This begins in the late 1800s, but really becomes modern only in the last 25 or 30 years. Before that, there really was no idea of depression, schizophrenia, obsessive-compulsive disorder.
Mm-hmm.
All we knew is that these people were not functioning. They may have been diagnosed in terms of a spiritual disconnection with their God,
right.
Or just ostracized as being different and strange.
That's really true.
The idea that these are illnesses that we can address and treat and help is really very new.
It is relatively new, isn't it? You know, I think a lot of people also have this belief that everybody who is a psychiatrist or even a psychologist, you know, the stereotype in the media about the patient who comes in and lays on a couch and the psychiatrist, or usually psychiatrist, talks to them like Freud, you know, that whole stereotype about Freud. I mean, and how does that, you know, that's one of the most common lines written in films. How does that make you feel?
And how does this make you feel? So you feel that way, eh?
Exactly.
Right.
Do you think this is still commonly used, this kind of therapy? Or how far do you think things have come since?
It has come remarkably far.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got to remember that in Freud's day, Freud began as a neurologist. Mm-hmm. And he was remarkable in his ability to observe human behavior, both what was there and what was missing. And he used that to define a type of psychotherapy called psychoanalysis.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, there was nothing else available
right.
to learn from other than observing behavior. We didn't have x-rays. We didn't have MRI scans. Mm. We didn't have the wonderful tools, both technological and psychometric, that we have these days
right.
to get a good idea of what's going on and then to define a treatment or intervention.
Right.
Before he was working with what he had, which was his own ears and his own brain.
Yes.
Yeah. We've come a little bit further than that.
Yes. Well, he was a genius, though, wasn't he, with the defense mechanisms that we create?
A brilliant, brilliant man. And it would have been wonderful to see what he could have done if he would have had different tools.
Exactly. Boy, he would have probably advanced it incredibly so if he were living today.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I just wanted to throw in something. I do get questions from time to time from listeners that ask me, is there really such thing as a subconscious in our minds? And you being the psychiatrist, I think, can probably best answer that. What do you feel about that?
I think the answer is absolutely,
mm-hmm.
but it's not what we thought about before.
Okay.
When I think about subconscious right now, I think about neurologic functions which occur at a level other than consciousness.
Right.
We're conscious about our thoughts, our words, but we're not conscious about our blood pressure and how much insulin our body's putting out. We don't know everything our body's doing at any given moment.
Right.
We have the ability to learn and to organize information at levels that we're not aware of, we're not consciously aware of, and they may define how we respond to the world. They may define our reality.
Yeah.
Not the only reality out there, but they define it, and that's what I think of as the unconscious. It's all those subroutines playing in the background that if you look hard enough for, you may be able to find and affect,
mm-hmm.
But we're not initially aware of.
Okay. So do we subconsciously create defense mechanisms that we're not really aware of in order to protect ourselves?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh,
and those
uh-huh.
defense mechanisms may be thought of as habits.
Uh-huh, okay.
And we all have habits, good and bad. I mean, brushing your teeth in the morning is a wonderful habit to have.
Yeah.
but if it's a bad habit, if it takes you to some place that's not as good or not as functional, we can change it if we're aware of it. As we say, it takes both intention and attention, but it's doable.
Right. And we'll talk about a little bit more about medications and how they can help folks change behaviors and thoughts. And literally, as I said earlier at the beginning of the show, how people have come into me and said about you personally, this guy saved my life.
So well, that's good
it's
to
like,
hear.
Yeah, exactly. Because you knew what was going on within them and you prescribed the right amount of medication or the right medication, and it literally changed their lives.
Absolutely.
You know,
we were talking before yeah. about interesting situations or
oh, yeah.
What was most gratifying. And in my practice, some of the best outcomes and the most wonderful moments are the first time I have a chance to see someone who has had a lifelong problem with mood swings or
mm.
attention deficit disorder,
mm-hmm.
And they know that there's something wrong. They're
right.
ashamed of there being something wrong, but they can't put the pieces together. All they know is that they start projects, they can't finish them,
right.
they can't have relationships,
mm.
and that they're failing in life.
Right, right.
And if you can put that together for them in a way that's understandable, that you can connect the dots,
mm-hmm.
that it really is a life-changing, a life-affirming experience, even within that first hour, even before you think about the possibility of using medication.
That's wonderful. Do you, in your, say, consultation or ongoing treatment sometimes, do you, you know, explain to people? Because I think sometimes people want to hear, you know, general physical information. Do you tell them sometimes about different neurohormones that they're either not producing or what some of the research has shown about, you know, why maybe you are experiencing depression chemically, that kind of thing?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think one of the best rules to follow is that things should just make sense, the JMS rule. And if people can understand, they should understand the nature of their problems, the genetics, the learning, and the psychophysiology and biology of it,
so that
treatment and intervention and change just make sense.
Yes.
It makes things work a lot easier and it helps them be motivated and also tolerate the time it takes for these changes to have effect.
Do you have any I know you and I have shared experiences with clients before at the clinic, and some of them were fascinating. I mean, we've had people we've worked with who have the multiple personality disorder. You know, they've changed into people don't, you know, there's a new television series on right now called The United States of Helen or something like that.
Of Tara,
that's it. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
It's really cool. She does a really good job. And it's quite accurate. So, I mean, they must have some kind of expert either on the set or helping them with the script, because it really is it's fascinating. It's humorous a bit, but it's not making fun of. It's just more of understanding the disorder. But what to you, and I'm not really necessarily focusing on this kind of disorder, but what are some of the most fascinating patient cases that you could share with us?
Certainly the whole idea of dissociation, multiple personality disorder, other dissociative states, is very dramatic, and it can be very traumatic for individuals and families.
Right.
But those sometimes present with some of the more interesting and colorful histories. Otherwise, it's really a whole process of helping things make sense.
Right.
Sometimes we think we make sense, and the patient in reality teaches us otherwise. I remember once in residency, we had two individuals on a psychiatric unit who both were delusional and thought that they were Jesus Christ.
Yeah, is that the delusions of grandeur we hear about all the time?
Absolutely.
Right. You're some famous person, or probably, is Jesus one of the most common figures who people...
Yeah, absolutely. So we thought see what would happen if we put them both in the same group.
Oh, good.
If they were going to conflict with each other
and
argue, and nothing happened. It was just, I'm Jesus Christ, that's fine. And you're too? Yes, thank you.
Okay. So they were willing actually to rationalize that there could be more...
or they were so irrational that all that mattered was their delusion.
Ah, okay. So they were Jesus, and yes, you are too. That's fascinating.
I wish we could all be that tolerant.
I know. So that's a very positive spin on that disorder there.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, it's. I remember when I worked in San Francisco before I came back to Los Angeles to pursue psychology, and we had a gentleman we called the King. He had a delusion of grandeur that he was probably a king of England at some particular time period. Every day at noon, he would stroll down. It was Polk Street. I remember it was like Bush, I think, was the cross street. He would stroll down Polk Street from his residence, go into this restaurant, and order the same meal. He was quite wealthy. He had an inheritance, so he didn't have to hold a job, thank goodness. He probably couldn't hold a job. His delusion was that he was the king, and he wore a full garb. He had a beautiful crown. He had the robe. He had velvet slacks. He always was dressed like a royal king from an earlier time period. And people began to accept him for who he was, because he would play the role. He was sitting in that restaurant. And we check on him every day because we, you know, walk by that particular restaurant that was right down the street from where I worked. And he was definitely a friend in the neighborhood. Everyone accepted him and played along with his role.
So we can think of these very colorful people. I had one woman who came in proclaiming that she was queen of all the land between the Nile and the Mississippi. I think it's also important to realize that the vast, vast majority of the patients we see aren't this ill and aren't this far off the beaten path, but really have subtle issues that are just enough to afford them difficulty and discomfort.
Right.
And they say you don't have to be crazy to get help.
Well, that's my point. I mean, everybody has depression, anxiety, fears. We all have scary thoughts from time to time, self-doubt. We all do. But isn't it the extent to which we feel these things and how they affect the way we function?
When it starts taking over your life and defining it rather than being a problem that you struggle with in life, that's when it really starts taking you offline.
So
that's when you need some type of intervention or help.
Yes. Yeah. You can't work anymore. You can't keep a job. You can't get up. You can't get out of the house, maintain friendships, let alone romantic relationships. You know, a lot of people kind of stop grooming. They don't have the energy, as they say a lot of times.
Or even if you can keep all those things going,
yes,
that you wear at some level that you're working a little bit too hard to do that you're putting 120% of the effort in to get 80% of a product out. You're doing it with more difficulty than the guy or gal next to you.
Yes, yes. And usually people can recognize this because of their feeling like they're not producing. And also, I think a lot of friends and family members are helpful sometimes, and that maybe people could listen a little better to what their family and friends are saying in terms of their concerns for them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think the most important word there is the ability to listen.
Yes.
What's important is not having the right thing to say, but being able to listen and respond reasonably.
Exactly.
That's how you listen that counts.
Right. It's really true. And, you and I were also talking about patients who can be, as I call it, addicted to the drama in their relationships. On my website, I have this little thing that I've written up about being addicted to drama. I'm fascinated with the personality disorders in the DSM, which are called the Axis II personality.
The drama kings and queens, the people who are the so-called rageaholics.
Right.
But often, if you look back in these individuals, there's very frequently a history of recurrent trauma or exposure to high-stress situations in early childhood, throughout childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And it does something to that child's brain. The constant exposure to stress hormones, norepinephrine and cortisol, affect that child's brain and changes it.
Wow.
Such that later on, during quiet times when things are peaceful, the brain wants it, doesn't like it.
Yes.
Wanting and liking are not the same thing.
Yes.
But it sure wants it.
Uh-huh.
And it's very much like an addiction.
Right.
The brain goes into withdrawal. It wants to fix it. And you can fix that withdrawal state by engaging in drama and trauma and argument and confrontation. Hmm. And you can fix it in the quiet and comfort of your own head simply by getting into a state of negative self-amping, of getting into those negative thoughts that churn and churn to the point that you can feel those hormones flow. And it is an intoxicated state. When you're in the middle of it, you can't communicate well, you can't attend to the world outside.
Yes.
And afterwards, when you're finally done, people usually describe themselves as feeling washed out, wiped out.
Mm-hmm.
They're hungover.
Right. Right. Yes.
And you can stop that. It's just like an addiction. But you have to be willing to identify what it is and then learn the cognitive techniques that are useful to block that occurrence.
Right.
And medications can also be useful in cooling down that whole cycle.
So it's, learning, having impulse control techniques to manage those outbursts and that drama and that need to stir up things with people. But what kind of medications can help with that kind of problem?
Well, frequently the same situations are combined with a history of anxiety or depression, and we use those medications for depression to help cool down the state and reduce the kind of the background noise in family situations that drive this process.
Mm.
Truth be told, there's two types of inheritance to these issues. One is the genetics, what you have in your chromosomes, and the other is the learned inheritance, growing up in a family where there's a tradition of this type of high expressed emotion and tolerance of drama and trauma.
Right. So if you have both in your family, that's not a good thing necessarily for the outcome of your, you know, mental state when you become a young adult sometimes.
You can't change your chromosomes, but you can affect how you respond to them and deal with them, both with therapy and with medication.
Mm-hmm.
And the most important issue there for the future is that if you can get a hold of it, you can change the learned inheritance for next generations.
Right.
You can change how this is handed down.
Yes. And I think if more people really heard that, and I hope they're getting help today from just listening to you, that is how they can get help. A lot of people tell me, oh, well, you know, I have a hot temper, and I do argue with my brother all the time, or whoever in my family. But, you know, my dad was Irish. You know, I hear things like this. Or, you know, my family was just like that, because that's how they communicated with each other, and that's what I learned. But knowing that this not only was learned, but it did trigger those neurohormones, and that they become addicted to that high level of chemistry in their brain, and that this is, a lot of it is chemical. Yes, it's learning, but they've also created it from the learning to a chemical state to where they can, you know, well, help themselves, because they're not going to be functioning quite well at work, socially, in the family environment, if they're explosive, if they're dramatic.
Uh-huh. Right. We learn through repetition and rehearsal.
Yes.
And it changes our neurobiology, our chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
And it also changes our neuroanatomy about how we reinforce nerve connections.
Yes.
And you can change that, but it goes back to what we said before about habits and the ability to identify these issues with both attention and intention.
Right.
To do it differently.
Mm-hmm. That is so fascinating. And maybe you could mention how far, just to let people know, because a lot of people don't understand what medications can do for them, but maybe tell listeners how far psychiatry has come in terms of being able to help people with diagnoses like depression, anxiety, you know, OCD, obsessive compulsive, and schizophrenia, which is a really difficult disorder to manage. But do these medications really work, a lot of people ask me?
They really do work, and they can be very effective. And we've come light years, even from when I was in residency 26 years ago, 27 years ago.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
We have medications. We have tools to start probing the neurobiology and neurophysiology of these issues that we couldn't even dream about at that time.
Wow.
When I was a resident, there was the idea of neurotransmitters was more theory than practical.
Yes.
And today we think about neurotransmitter subsystems, receptor size blockades, augmentation strategies.
Yeah.
We have tools that were not available then.
Right.
And we'll have tools in another 10 or 15 years that we can just barely dream about now.
Isn't that wonderful?
This last year we saw the FDA approve a magnetic tool, which
yes.
may be very effective for treatment refractory depression, and may also have a place in treating treatment refractory schizophrenia with auditory hallucinations.
Really?
We have vagal nerve stimulation now for people who don't respond well to medications and depression.
Yes.
And the future, it's just, the future is going to be wonderful in this regard.
It is. Remember the olden days when people used to fear? I mean, I know they still do electroconvulsive, you know, therapy. I know they still do that. And, of course, they have it down to a fine science now.
Absolutely. It is not the same thing. It is not my father's ECT.
Right. Exactly.
It's very different and very safe and very,
yes.
very effective when other things don't work.
Yes, especially for major, major depressive disorder.
And it really got a bad name early on in the 40s and 50s when there was no other treatment.
Right.
There was nothing else to do, so it was overused or even abused.
Right.
Because it's the only thing we had that worked for something.
Right, right. And you know, also in the media, I mean, they portrayed it as, you know, it's almost like Frankenstein-type, you know, treatments that they used to do. They'd zap people and, you know, oh, I'm going to be a vegetable when I come out from this. But they have come so far today. Dr. Croman, I have a couple of questions here from listeners. If it's okay, can I read them to you? And
sure.
Maybe you can we can shoot from the hip here. Okay. It says, Dear Dr. Michelle, can you ask your psychiatrist what contributes to getting a mental illness? She goes on to say, my parents tell me that sometimes we can inherit it from relatives, and I'm kind of worried because my mom says things like, quote, she has a quote here, my grandma and my aunt were sad a lot and many times stayed in bed for many days. So does this mean that she had depression, and does that mean that I could get it too? And this is from Adriana, looks like.
We hear those histories all the time of Aunt Griselda, who would lock herself in her room for 6 months at a time, or every winter would just hole up, or Uncle Zeke, who had strange ideas. Mm-hmm. And these issues are genetic. There are risk factors that run in families. Mm-hmm. And the more we're aware about them, the more we can do something about them. So the genetics is not something to be afraid of, but something to be aware of so we can address things more accurately and hopefully earlier.
Right.
And what I said before is important, too, that there's two types of inheritance.
Mm-hmm.
There's the tissue inheritance, the chromosomal issues, mm-hmm. but also the learned inheritance growing up in a family where safety, mm-hmm. communication, affiliation may all be distorted mm-hmm. by depression or mood swings,
right.
So that it becomes a learned process as well.
Hmm.
And yes, there is a risk factor there, but a risk factor is not a life sentence. It means it's something
right.
that you can be aware of and take care of.
Okay, that's good. So I hope, Adriana, I hope he helped you, answer that question. I have one more that I'd like to shoot to you here, and maybe it'll help other people too as well. Okay. It says, Dear Dr. Michelle, my younger sister is 23 and is worrying me. She is still trying to finish college, but sometimes stays up for days in a row with lots of energy and likes to party with her friends. She says, I don't think she's doing drugs. When I call her, she sometimes talks, she puts in quotes, 100 miles an hour, and is really mean to me and screams at me for no reason. Other times she's very nice and acts normal, but I never know what kind of mood she's going to be in. What do you think could be wrong with her? And this is from Brianna in Nevada. So there you go.
Well, I think what we know is wrong is that her behavior is unpredictable
right.
and at times uncomfortable, more than uncomfortable. It's destructive to her relationships, at least her relationship with her sister.
Yes.
We can't tell exactly what's going on, if it's some type of mood instability or drugs, but certainly we go back to the whole idea of how you listen to someone when you see something that's not explainable, that looks out of context.
Right.
You know, the old saw is that you strike when the iron is hot.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of those occasions when that's absolutely not true,
mm.
that you strike when the iron's cold. So at a quiet time, when things
yes.
are kind, when they're peaceful,
yes.
that you can come back to this woman and look at her and say, you know, we were talking the other night. Things were just not right.
Right.
Tell me what's going on. What did you experience? I'll tell you what I saw. There's something that's just not right here.
Yeah.
And you can open the subject.
Yes.
And that's the best thing you can do.
I think that's a great idea. I think that's, you know, that's the best thing you can do. And this is great advice for folks out there who have relatives that seem a little unstable at times, to talk to them and not gang up on them, but just explain to them how you know, you're observing them and when they're calmer.
Mm-hmm. So, it's a matter of the facts, not a matter of the faults.
Yes. Oh, that's a great way of putting it. Well, I know you have patients probably waiting for you in your office.
That I do have to do.
And I thank you so much for being on my show with me. It's such a pleasure personally to know you and also have worked with you. And you're always a great guest. I just love having you on my show. And folks, again, it's Dr. Alan Crowman. He's a general and psychiatric psychiatrist and also an assistant clinical professor over at UCLA, which is... major. The man knows everything about psychiatry. If there's a way people may have questions or would like a consultation with you, would it be okay? Would it be appropriate to give a number where they could contact you?
Certainly. My office number is 310-284-8500.
Okay.
And I'm in West Los Angeles.
Okay.
Michelle, it's wonderful working with you, and
thank
it's wonderful
you.
To be able to share this this time on the air with you.
Oh,
it's
thank
been
you
a
so
great
much.
Opportunity.
Well, as always, you're wonderful on the air. So thank you so much, Alan, for your time. I sure appreciate it. And
take good care.
Have a good one.
Okay,
bye-bye. All right. That was so – you know what, guys? That is so interesting because we're getting so much information about how chemical changes – in our brains really do affect us. And, you know, I do want to mention, too, at the same time, I mean, psychiatrists do help us manage depression, anxiety, obsessive-compulsive behaviors, of course, schizophrenia, different kinds of chemical imbalances, as they call them. And there's no stigma to that. It just happens sometimes. We inherit it. There are certain triggers in our early environment that sets us off, whatever they are. But it's wonderful that you can get help these days, and it's gone so far, as Dr. Croman said, in helping people. And really, I have seen 180s with people with schizophrenia who've had voices, you know? They're talking to somebody else, or they're hearing somebody else. And they've had 180-degree changes, complete opposite from some of the medications that they're put on. And the medication, there are side effects sometimes, but I mean, I've seen miracles happen with a lot of people. Antidepressants, yes, they are effective. Anti-anxiety medications, yes, they really are effective, and they do help people chill out. So if you are experiencing or see anyone in your family or really good friends who are not really functioning, you know, they're not able to pick themselves up and kind of move on with their lives, and they can't do well, and they're just falling down, they're getting worse, you might, when they're in a mellower time, you might chat with them or have a family member or a couple of family members come together and say, we really love you. We're really concerned, you know, about how you're functioning. Because you know you're not getting up, you know, you don't look great like you used to. To fix yourself up, you used to put makeup on, you used to bathe more often, you know, your hair looks funky, we're worried about you. And sometimes to a family member, if you come from you don't accuse them of anything, you don't come off like, you know, they have to be defensive towards you. Lovingly is really the best way to talk to someone who you see falling down, becoming more depressed, you know, whatever their symptoms are, and you see a change in them. You know, what's interesting, too, is most of the diagnosis for chemical imbalances or mental illnesses, they start around, in the Diagnostics and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, they start around like 18 years of age, many of them. They start to really form, you start to really see them when the person becomes a young adult, you know. So we have a caller on the line. Let's check in, see if somebody... And by the way, folks, if you want to call me, you know, you can share your stuff, stories, 323-203-0815. And we have a caller on the line. See if I can pull this caller up. All right, let me answer this. Nope. Hi, you're with Dr. Michelle on the air.
Yes, hi, Dr. Michelle.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing great.
Great. Did you have a chance to hear the doctor a little bit earlier?
A little bit, yeah. Great. Yeah, I've been listening.
Great.
Interesting stuff. Interesting stuff. So, I got a problem.
Okay.
And I hope you can help me with this.
All right.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I get around crowds.
Yeah.
I get really anxious and very nervous and very agitated.
Okay.
My roommate says that I have claustrophobia. I don't know about that, but
okay.
It's just people make me, when I get around a bunch of people,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just feel like they are just, I just start feeling very socially conscious.
Okay.
Is there any tools that you can help me deal with this anxiousness that I feel?
Sure.
I mean, I'll be in a theater and I'll start feeling weird.
Okay, like you're in a movie theater and there's a lot of people around you at one time?
Yes.
Okay. How about if you're, let's say, out in public, like waiting in a line somewhere, if there's a lot of people around you in a public place, does that make you feel uncomfortable?
Makes me feel very uncomfortable.
Okay. How about if you're in a situation, I don't know, like a party or something, and there's not that many people, they're scattered out? But can you manage that kind of a situation?
Yeah, but yeah, when I'm around a lot of people, it's just, if I know the people, that's all right. But I just feel very anxious with people, and I'm trying to master this, and I'm finding it really, really difficult.
Okay, So when you talk, when your roommate says that you may be claustrophobic, do you have problems, say, in small spaces like elevators or airplanes or anything like that?
I haven't been on an airplane for a long time, so I don't like airports.
You don't like airports? Too many. Nobody likes airports.
Too many.
Right, exactly. So, okay. So you're not... how about an elevator? When you're in an elevator, are you uncomfortable with by yourself or people?
Just for a short period of time, and I'm not really on that many elevators, and I've not really noticed that.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So what sounds to me like, and I hear that your phone may be fading out, but let me just tell you, what it sounds to me like is that it doesn't sound like a social phobia. You're not afraid if you're like speaking in front of a crowd or something like that, right?
I don't have that opportunity to do that, but that would probably be very nerve-wracking for me.
Okay, all right. So what I'm getting from you though is that, I mean, you work, right?
Yes.
And so do you deal with the public, or are you kind of locked away in a little space, or are you dealing with the public on a regular basis?
Yes.
Okay. And does it make you uncomfortable, or are you cool? Are you okay about doing that?
Fine one-on-one.
Okay.
But it's just, I feel like people are watching me and looking at me,
and
I just start feeling very, very withdrawn.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really a shy person because I work on the phone a lot, mm-hmm. and I talk to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very outgoing that way, but when I get around, when I'm in a crowd, like at a department store or mall or a theater or whatever, I just get very uncomfortable, and I feel like I just get anxious, and it really bothers me.
Okay. Well, I can't really diagnose you on the air, and it's not fair to do that, but it sounds like, you know, you have a pretty good deal of social anxiety. Since you talk to a lot of people, I don't know if you have a fear of being in front of crowds and feeling like you have to perform. That's something different. It sounds to me like you might have some sort of claustrophobic issue going on, to where too many people around you, too much, just may be too much energy for you, and you just have to get out of that particular situation. When you're in that crowd, when you're in a department store or whatever, and there's lots of people around you, what do you do to help yourself?
I just get out of there as quickly as possible.
Okay. So you get out into the open, into where there's not very many people. And that's okay, and that helps you out.
Right. Okay. I sometimes can't breathe.
Okay. Okay. So you're having some panic symptoms.
Is that what they're called?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, if you're having shortness of breath, or you're having palpitations... right, your heart starts beating really fast. You may feel a little dizzy or disoriented. Does that happen to you?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't really get, but if I stay, I know that I would probably start feeling dizzy if I didn't get there.
Okay. Okay.
More like what's called fight or flight syndrome.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And does it? So, go ahead.
Get out. I just get really nervous, and the people I'm with, you know, Sean, calm down, man, you know, just relax.
Yeah.
Cool it, man.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, I hear
it's
what
like,
you're saying.
It's like, hey, I can't chill. I just can't chill.
Right. So it's really about being around crowds. It's just feeling claustrophobic around a great deal of people. And that could be, I don't know, and you don't have these so-called panic symptoms just when you're by yourself or just out of the blue.
No.
Right, okay. So you probably don't have panic disorder, so you're not having these panic attacks just that come upon you from, you know, just stress. So,
I can check panic disorder off my list of insecurity.
Okay. All right. It's not necessarily an insecurity. It's just it's sometimes a chemical imbalance that sometimes we inherit, or just, you know, from too much stress that builds up. That's the kind of delayed reaction we have. But you know what? It sounds like, you know, you may have some claustrophobic issues definitely, when it comes to being around too many people, if you're in a smaller space, and you told me you had to get out or get away from it and you feel better. So you know what they have, and I can refer you to someone. Where are you at anyway?
I'm in Southern California.
Okay. All right, so you're down in Southern. What I can do is I can have, you know, my assistant get back to you, and I can refer you to someone further down south from where we're at, and maybe they can help you. You know, they're called cognitive behavioral therapists, and I don't mean to get technical or boring or anything, but what you can do is you can work on, it's called exposure. See, people who have, phobias or claustrophobia, the best treatment sometimes is exposure to that. So the more you get exposed, you learn to that environment, you learn that it's not as scary as it really is. And someone who's really good in that kind of treatment can work you through that and talk you through that and get you to take steps to expose yourself to a very crowded environment so you won't be freaking out. So you can comfortably go to a movie and sit there and not have a panic, attack.
Suggest I do? I mean, when this starts happening.
Okay, what I suggest you do is for now, until you get someone who can, really kind of work with you on behavior mechanisms and thinking about things, is I would say whatever makes you feel most comfortable, which is getting out of that situation. Whatever's going to make you feel more comfortable, I would say do it. And if you're in that situation and you can't get out, there are some people who are stuck and like in the subway situations I've heard, or, really very crowded situations, and they really start getting panicky and disoriented and dizzy and they feel like they're going crazy. You can breathe. I mean, one of the quickest ways to automatically change your body is to start taking control of your breathing. And what you can do is start breathing very slowly. And that's one of the first lines of defense. While you're trying to get out, while you calmly turn around and try to get out of that huge crowd or find an exit to where you can be, feeling more comfortable. And the breathing is relaxing breathing. It's you breathe, start to take control. Think about your breath. Don't think about anything except your breath. So you think about breathing in through your nose very high. Breathe all the way up through your nose, and then breathe out through your mouth slowly through your mouth again. And breathe in through your nose again very slowly, as high as you can go, and breathe out through your mouth. There, you're automatically changing your breath. You're starting to change the physiology, because if your breath, is slowed, your pulse is slowed, your heart rate is slower, you can get control. It's helping you kind of control yourself a little bit. So that's the first way to really start doing it. And know that you're going to be okay. Just know that you're not going to die. nothing is going to happen. Just calmly get yourself away from that situation that's uncomfortable. Take over by focusing on your breathing, and that'll be the first line of helping you. And you through techniques, and like I said, I'll have my assistant turn you on maybe to someone down in your area.
How do I reach you?
Well, I will go ahead and I will have my assistant, when I get off the air, I'll just have her take your number and I'll get back to you. And that's the way we'll do it, okay?
That's wonderful.
Okay, Sean.
I will work on I'm going to a movie tonight.
Oh, okay.
And I will work on my breathing.
Okay. All right.
Should I do any counting?
No. Like, what do you mean counting?
Like breathe, like five.
Oh yeah.
Four.
Oh yeah. No. Just go ahead and just breathe slowly in through your nose and out through your mouth, very slowly. Do it like five or six times, or whenever you start to feel, a little calmer, Just you're taking control, and that's the most important thing. All right.
Okay.
All right, Sean.
That's okay.
Thank you so much for calling.
I don't do that. I don't do that. I just normally just get out.
That's right.
I will do the breathing.
Well,
that's very helpful.
Get out of the environment as well until you can slowly learn how to expose yourself and not be fearful of that situation, all right?
Okay.
All right, Sean.
I love your show.
Great. Thank you for calling in. It's so nice to hear from you, and good luck to you with that. And have a great, enjoy your theater experience. Get on an end aisle seat, right? So you can, you know, if you have to just get out and leave and for a little bit, don't put yourself in the middle of the whole thing. Put yourself on the side where you feel safer, where you're managing it, okay?
Okay, I'll do that.
Good luck to you on that, and thank you for calling, and hold on the line, and I'll have my assistant to get you turned on to somebody down south who can help you.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks, Dr. Michelle.
Sure. Have a great day, Sean. All right, very good. We have to go. Wow, it's about that time. Anyway, if you'd like to contact me, if you have some questions, I can maybe answer them on the air for you here at LA Talk Radio. You can find me on my website at drmichelletherapy.com. It's drmichelle with two L's, therapy.com. Or go ahead and email me. That's cool, too. Have questions? I will get back to you. It's docmichelle, D-O-C, Michelle at AOL.com, and we can talk. Maybe I can help you and or refer you to someone in your area, because we are international here at LA Talk Radio. So thank you so much for listening today. I got to go. We're moving on here. Wow, there's my music. It's Dr. Michelle, your friendly psychologist. Stay tuned for TJ McCormick. Yeah, I hear you. Come on in. He's here. He's always here. Have a great day, everybody, and I'll talk to you next Friday live. Meanwhile, download other stuff and take good care. Bye-bye. Of sound, but I see you.